This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
How is it bearable for tender creatures such as ourselves to bear witness to the events of our world?
Psychoanalyst Judith Deutsch is a hybrid, an American transplanted to Canada. She studied history and literature at UCLA and social work at UC Berkeley. Judy was trained in child psychoanalysis in the States and then adults at the Toronto Psychoanalytic Institute. While treating people in her private practice, Judy advocates for peace, human rights, and socialism. She is a widely published columnist and reviewer of books, who last appeared on Radio EcoShock in February 2019. Judy Deutsch, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I guess I want to thank you for all the wonderful programs and interviews that you've done over time. I think I've listened to your program from the beginning. So it's a wonderful source of information about climate change.
I almost feel sorry for you if you've listened to all those shows. A lot of bad news, but some good news in there, too. Well, look, we could talk for hours about 100 things, you and I, but today we're asking a simple question, I think. As climate disasters hit home during a global pandemic, are we witnessing a flowering of mass psychosis? And so we should start with the basics. In your view, what is mass psychosis?
You know, it's a complicated question because psychosis is an individual problem, a pathology, descriptively having to do with the loss of the sense of reality. So in that way, the fact that there's not a facing of many realities with regard to climate, you know, you could call it a psychosis, but I don't think that it is. That concept of a mass psychosis, too, was most, I guess, famously applied for the Hitler Third Reich, about whether fascism was a manifestation of a mass psychosis. But that concept is very much questioned. I guess my answer is that I don't think that what we're looking at with respect to the public popular reaction to climate or to COVID can be called a mass psychosis.
Well, as the COVID-19 pandemic shows, medical diseases can be contagious, but can mental disease be contagious?
No, they can't, in the same way as a disease can, but understanding group processes, you know, how people relate to each other is quite complicated and much more variable than, you know, just being able to say it's a mass psychosis. I was thinking about this topic with regard to climate change, but and the reactions to it by various groups, NGOs, people in the government, scientists, people in various political movements, and there's many factors, and, you know, how do people react to huge threats? There was a book that I recently read that I was extremely impressed with. It was called Herodotus in the Anthropocene by Joel Schlosser. He's a political scientist, but he uses the word throughout the book. He calls it dynamic complexity, and I think that is very applicable to understanding the climate system as well as Freudian psychology is one of dynamic complexity, and the social political world is one of dynamic complexity.
That makes it especially hard to define or nail down because it is dynamic, it's changing, and it is complex. Did Freud talk about group madness at all?
He talked about group psychology, but not group madness. He was looking at about the role of authority, particularly in very hierarchical institutions like the military or the church, and people's reactions to authority. At times, you know, for people to group together, identifying with the authority or also reacting defensively to their own hostility to authority, you know, that can be a very useful and important question when you look at group processes.
I know that in Canada and in other countries, hundreds of people gathered in angry crowds outside hospitals. They were apparently protesting against doctors and nurses inside trying to save lives from COVID-19. That sounds to me a bit like madness. I'm sure the people that are protesting have their own logic, but where does the anger against medicine and science come from, do you think?
It's hard to interpret individual beliefs and the causes for those beliefs from a group behavior where everybody seems to be behaving the same way, but they could be from many different reasons. It certainly seems mad in the sense that it's out of touch with knowledge and with reality, that it comes from various roots, you know, partly anxiety, you know, or even panic. But the belief about what you're panicking about can be very, very distorted. So amongst, you know, young people, there's probably, I would imagine, you know, there's very real anxiety that can get quite out of hand about their future, about the living conditions and so on and so forth. There's also beliefs about authority that are, in a sense, I call them sometimes pathogenic beliefs, because there's kind of a reaction that some people have about, you know, like, you're not going to tell me what to do, so that anything that's mandatory or that's a rule that there's a tendency to feel suspicious of or anxious about. And so there's a lot of avenues for distorted thinking.
I think there's been a long-standing alternative school that says the masses are deluded and those who object are the sane ones. The British psychiatrist R.D. Lang thought madness was a rational reaction to a world gone mad, and we have the French thinker Michel Foucault. What do you think about that? I mean, it seems like society itself is like the Pope. It's infallible. A society cannot be insane. But then we look at nuclear weapons, we look at climate change, we look at a lot of things that say, well, maybe society can be the insane body.
I don't think so. And I've been thinking about this for quite a long time, certainly around climate, you know, because I've been paying attention to that really since Hansen's original testimony. So that was in the early 1990s or even a little bit before that, but you know, and I've had a lot of experience with various environmental groups. And, you know, one of my positions here in Toronto was with Science for Peace, and I was one of the main organizers of a meeting with James Hansen, Naomi Klein, and Creighton Thomas Powell. This is the beginning of when they, you know, began to collaborate or anything. And I think that there's a lot of responsibility by people who are in positions of authority or power, you know, that it's very difficult, you know, to have a basic reality understanding of what's going on. I'll give you two examples, maybe. For instance, in Al Gore's movie, Inconvenient Truth, you know, he showed a lot of the climate processes that were known at that time. And at the very end, he gave very simplistic solutions, you know, like to change your light bulbs, or for at that time, like David Suzuki, there were posters, you know, in the Toronto subway system about caulking your windows. So there was such a discrepancy between the reality of what was known about danger and what was proffered as a solution. Those kinds of things are so confusing. There's so much of that so confusing to the public. So it's not that simply that people, you know, are blind to it, but possibly very confused. Naomi Klein is another person that she, you know, after the Paris climate meeting and the 2018 report, I heard in an interview, you know, she's saying in a very upbeat voice, you know, like, that she thought that we could limit climate change to a rise of temperature to 1.5 degrees Celsius. That's just very ignorant. Or another example is even like from Noam Chomsky, who only very lately has focused on climate change. And he says repeatedly that it's a threat to civilization as we know it. You know, that's so vague, and I think it's very confusing. It really conveys, you know, both, all these things convey that there's no threat to human life, really.
Well, no wonder we're confused. I mean, things are so very, very differently, changing so rapidly, and it looks like whether you're a leader at the top or a consumer of information at the bottom, it's just confusing. Nobody's really sure what's going on. This is brand new. So look, I want to bring out a fresh poll. I just saw an announcement today in The Lancet about this. It was in 10 countries, including the UK, US, but also India, Nigeria, and the Philippines. And in it, two-thirds of young people did not trust governments to act on climate change. And among thousands of young people surveyed, over half think humanity is doomed. So, Judy, how can we expect good mental health under those circumstances?
In one way, I think that that's really quite heartening, you know, that youth are correctly appraising the danger. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to have, quote, mental health problems. From a Freudian point of view, you know, anxiety is not a disorder. It can be a very realistic appraisal of reality, and it can lead to very realistic kinds of responses, which I think are there. You know, I think that there are many people, scholars and so on, who are doing excellent work in figuring out what really needs to be done. I think this is particularly true it's been for a long time, for instance, in agriculture, you know, that there's very, very good thinking, you know, and certainly in the science of climate change, there's much more complex views or understanding of what some of the processes are and why things have to change really immediately. That's been something that's has been quite a huge evasion for you know, three decades now. That, you know, with Hansen's original testimony, you know, the conclusion that one would think would be that you have to, you know, regulate and mandate stopping emissions and eliminate them, and that seems to be taboo, you know, amongst so many people to think about stopping anything and regulating. So the fact that these, you know, all these youth and so many countries are realizing true danger, you know, that's the kind of thing that can lead to some effective action. You know, since the 2015 and 2018 reports, there hasn't been one, as far as I know, one mandatory action, regulation about actually stopping. You know, the timelines have been really ridiculous. I think probably Paul Beckwith has talked about it, but, like, you know, it's all very deceptive. Like, people saying, you know, well, we'll put a moratorium on the tar sands in 2030, or, you know, the idea of a carbon budget that takes no account of nonlinear feedbacks, positive feedbacks, is also just that is out of touch with reality. And the fact that that's been accepted by so many people in positions of authority, you know, that I find is a very disturbing group process.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Joining us from Canada is psychoanalyst, activist, and columnist Judith Deutsch. We're talking about mental health as the pandemic and climate disasters pound millions of humans. I think in the background of some listeners' minds would be this: if we feel anxious and even depressed about the pandemic and growing climate disasters, should we worry we are mentally ill?
No, I don't think so. I think that's the difference between Freudian psychology and, say, like, the American psychology, the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Diagnostic Manual. we can talk about a capacity for anxiety and a capacity for depression, that if you're not feeling some of those things, you're not facing reality. And it doesn't mean that those emotional states will cause helplessness, like the function of anxiety is to evaluate, you know, whether it's realistic or not. Not to just quickly say that, you know, that it's a disorder. Anxiety can be overwhelming and can paralyze, but it doesn't have to go in that direction. But again, if you're not feeling anxious, then you're not facing reality.
That's a great poster. I'm going to put that on a sign and march down the street. So I worry, though, that there's a kind of feedback effect here, Judy. Tools to suppress the contagion of COVID, you know, closing off key social ties, making family get-togethers difficult, meetings impossible, the arts, the sports. So isolated people can suffer mentally, and it drives them into anger against authority, and then that fuels resistance to social action, which we need to stave off both the pandemic and climate change. So we get into this loop, and I wonder, could mass mental illness actually be the main factor preventing us from solving life-threatening challenges here on this planet?
Well, yeah, I can certainly, you know, understand all the difficulties that people are facing because of the social isolation and the fears, you know, the very real fears about what this horrible disease can cause. But I don't think that is the cause of social, you know, political inaction. In my various groups I'm in and with the patients that I treat, you know, that there's a whole range of reactions to this. And some, you know, there's some things that I think are very, you know, have been quite helpful in terms of a lot of intellectual activity, I would say. You know, there's any number of study groups and Zoom meetings and so on and so forth. There's also been very interesting concepts that have come from it, which I think, you know, is something that I've noticed as a very detrimental aspect of the reaction to something like climate change, you know. There have been many, many essential concepts that have just dropped out, like, you know, looking at externalities and life cycle analyses, looking at asking where the information is coming from. James Hansen, again, has a, you know, it's a complex climate model in which he looks at paleoclimate record and modeling and very careful observation. There's concepts that I think are really essential. It's interesting that the initial reaction to this information was to eliminate greenhouse gases, and then over time that idea was just dropped out and it became adaptation and mitigation. And after a while that just dropped out. So, you know, the complex concepts have really disappeared, and I think that's hugely problematic. With COVID, one of the things that came out that was really very helpful was to look at essential production and non-essential production. And that would be a phenomenal way of also looking at what, you know, what we need to produce economically for people to survive versus what is non-essential. Well, again, unfortunately, you know, that was, I think, a very realistic reaction to COVID. Now that has dropped out. So these crises, these threats don't have an inevitable outcome. It's, one thing to pay more attention to is, why do these things drop out? What is the role of authority? Why aren't these shallow ideas challenged more?
Wow, this is a huge concept you've just brought up, that actually complex thought has been damaged in some way, and it could be due to social media and mass media. I know, looking way back to the 60s to Marshall McLuhan, he said that we would extend ourselves with media, but every extension of the mind is actually in some other place an amputation of the mind, that we give up some contact with actual reality in order to spend more time in this unreality. So perhaps that's what's happening to it almost sounds like we're developing holes in our brains under the stress, really, the way you're talking here.
It's more complex. You know, I think of the idea of the part for the whole, the pars pro toto in Latin. You know, it's a flaw in knowledge, you know. And that came, I think, with that there's an efflorescence of that under neoliberalism, actually. And that there was a lot more complex thinking at times in our society. It's, you know, things are different in different societies in different regions, you know, and some areas people do retain a lot more complex views, but I think it's been politically and economically very advantageous to reduce to the, you know, pars pro toto, you know, part for the whole kind of thinking. A lot, you know, and you know, there's the idea, you know, also about, you know, anti-intellectualism and anti-authority, and, you know, some of it even came from, I think, you know, postmodernism and so on, you know, that there's no reality even, you know, there's no facts, that everything, you know, that's a huge reductionism, and some of it, I've wondered if it's kind of comes from this idea of, you know, a complete misapplication of physics, you know, like Einstein's discovery of relativity and Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. It's like that's been extended to all areas of knowledge, you know, which is terribly detrimental to understanding dynamic complexity. But you see that in many academic fields, I think.
Well, I think of two things. First of all, China, over its long history, developed over, I don't know how many, but well over 100,000 characters in what we would call their alphabet. And then with the Chinese Communist Party, decided they had to draw it down to 5,000 characters so people would have a hope of grasping a common written language. We might see that in what's happened with modernism. But it does sound rather sad. I know that I've read books like A History of European Intellectualism, and it's a massive project that's developed over centuries. And today, very few of those names would mean anything to people because they haven't heard it on Fox News or MSNBC.
Exactly. That's right.
So, all right. So we both agree big changes need to happen. And if they don't, possibly millions of people will die in pandemics or climate disasters. What do you think about developing terms like eco-anxiety or eco-grief?
I don't like to use terms like that myself. You know, again, it's because of my quite individual focus in terms of psychology. What looks the same in terms of behavior, you know, has so many different meanings and different roots for people. And I worry that that closes off for people really thinking about trying to grasp a much more complex or a whole picture of what's going on.
To bring that to ground, though, perhaps we could say if someone says, oh, I'm just feeling eco-anxiety, then they're, in a sense, that's a nice cover for other things that they may be very anxious about from their own personal lives. Is that the sort of direction you're going with this?
That is. You know, I would ask that, but I would also wonder about what exactly is making them anxious about the ecological situation. And I've heard this in groups that I've been in and so on, that it's as if, you know, I felt eco-anxiety and that nothing can be done, so that there's not really an understanding, again, of what the situation is and what needs to be done. You know, people have the very individual reasons, and I respect that, you know, that some people have so many real difficulties in their, you know, their day-to-day lives because of poverty and illness and stuff, you know, so that, of course, they're not going to be able to deal with this. But there's a lot of other people who I think are in positions where they ought to be dealing with it much more realistically, certainly in academia and certainly the government and in environmental groups. They need to be much more aware, much more realistic.
Okay. There's a thousand more questions. I mean, I wonder, can a mad society heal itself? What do our listeners do to help their own mental balance and assist others? And there just isn't time to answer those, and there really aren't good answers either, I don't think. So can we leave it there?
Sure. Yeah, and thank you for your excellent questions and always your broad focus on climate and people and the political systems, too.
From Toronto, Canada, we've been speaking with psychoanalyst and social critic Judith Deutsch, and you can find links to some of her articles and Judy's Twitter feed in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Judy, thank you as always for your help.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.